Today on Maine Calling, stories from Maine cemeteries. Have you ever wandered through an old Maine cemetery and wondered about the people whose names are on the gravestones? Maybe you've noticed a cluster of markers for children or an unusual carving on the stone of a hand or an acorn or a tree stump. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Every old gravestone in Maine represents a life story, and as you might imagine, some of them are fascinating. A new book explores some of these stories, and its author is our guest today. For years, Ron Romano has been researching some of the secrets buried for years in Maine cemeteries. Stories of regular people whose gravestone might not reveal all. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For many people, old cemeteries are places of beauty and meaning, peace and perspective. They also contain multitudes of mystery. Today, we're going to learn about Maine cemeteries and some of the stories they hold. Joining me for the hour, Ron Romano, who is author of the new book, Stories from Maine Cemeteries, Lives Cut Short. He's a board member of Friends of Eastern Cemetery, as well as a lecturer and guide. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you ever explore cemeteries? Do you have a question about a gravestone or an area of a cemetery? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome, Ron, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here to talk about it.
Well, I've learned so much. And before we start about talking about specific graves or specific cemeteries, I want to talk about a couple of things I learned from you, Ron, that I didn't know. I think a lot of us all felt as though the whole concept of having a cemetery is very, very old, very ancient. And in New England, that's not the case, right? What we think of as a cemetery, a beautiful place with trees and grass and maybe gentle rolling hills, that's relatively recent.
That's absolutely right. So when we think about the colonial period of New England, especially, people really didn't have time to create cemeteries. They were burying their kin on their own backyards, basically. They just set aside a patch and put people there. For towns, they usually had a common burying ground that was open to everybody. Sometimes they had a sextant that would watch and monitor burials and sort of line people up. Other times it was a free-for-all, and it made sort of a mess of the place over time. And then there were churchyards, which were associated with meeting houses or churches. And those were spaces that were reserved for the congregants of the church and some neighbors. So there were three kind of categories that started off in the colonial period. And then in the 1800s, things really started to change. When in 1830, we saw the development of what's called the rural cemetery or the garden cemetery. And what happened was these inner city patches of churchyards and the common burying grounds were just getting too full because our population was exploding. And so they were looking for places to allow burial with a little bit more room. And so they went outside the cities to the urban areas. They called them rural cemeteries, and it was a model that came over from London. And what was really different about the rural cemeteries, it's more what you think of today, I think, Jennifer. These were large spaces, winding carriage paths were developed in them. They kept their water features. They planted shrubbery and trees, native trees, to help decorate. They created these interestingly shaped lots for families that were well-to-do to bury and then decorate with monuments of all different kinds and shapes. And so they really invited visitation. It was no longer like in the colonial period where you just went there to bury somebody and sometimes visited. Those were utilitarian spaces. These garden cemeteries or rural cemeteries were meant to be visited. And so that changed the movement entirely in both burial spaces, burial practices, materials used, symbolism, all of that sort of flowed through during that period of time, which makes it the most interesting century really to explore and write about.
So these rural or garden cemeteries come about in the early 1800s, early to mid 1800s. Which one was first in Maine?
So the first one is Mount Hope in Bangor. That was actually called was the second garden cemetery, but it was after there was one other, I forget where it was, but we have the claim to be the America's second garden cemetery. One of the little qualifier too, when these were first established, they were called rural cemeteries because they were purposely built outside city centers where there was more room to spread out. But of course, over time, as the cities continue to expand and envelop that space, people then refer to them as garden cemeteries because they look like gardens and they invite you in like a garden. So it's okay to call them rural or garden, but there's kind of a little evolution that occurred from the starting point when they were truly rurally located to now where they're part of the cemeteries, I mean, the city's fabric. So we call them garden cemeteries.
At first glance, someone like you, Ron, knows just by glancing at a stone and what it is made from, what era it's likely from. You know that slate is from a certain era, and marble is a certain era, and granite is a certain era, and I'm guessing even what kind of granite. But tell us about this. I think a lot of people love the old slate cemetery stones. Why? What years were those made, and why did we not continue with them?
Yeah, so the slate markers were available and in use from the middle 1600s to the middle 1800s. So they had about a 200-year run. That material was plentiful, easy to cut. So the stone cutters who were hand making these stones could easily, gouge into the stone and create their designs and lettering. And they were, for the most part, what we call tablet markers. They looked like, relatively small, similar design on many of them. Some of them are decorated, others are just inscribed. But the slate was in use because it was cheap and available, frankly. Around 1800, we saw the importation of marble from Europe. And although much of that marble, which was very expensive, was destined for homes in the form of furnishings, mantelpieces, and other pieces for the home, there were some that were reserved for grave markers. So well-to-do families might take a beautiful piece of white marble to the stone shop and say, "I want this for my family's monument." And then when they started to quarry marble out of the Connecticut River Valley, much closer to home, it became really available. And there was an explosion of marble in our cemeteries around 1840. And it was really in use until about the end of the century. So it had an almost 100-year run. And what people didn't realize with marble is that it is such a soft stone, it would create beautiful three-dimensional designs, but they would erode away over time. And they had to let that stone go after some time. And so granite then came in and took over. And that was at the end of the century. And that's the monument of choice today, material of choice today, because it's so strong and it needs to be machine cut, not hand cut. So the evolution is slate to marble to granite. And along the way, there was experiments with other materials like soapstone and sandstone and even metals. Zinc markers show up in our mid-century cemeteries as well. But all of it together gives us a really interesting walk through the space. It's all different and different colors and looks and shapes and designs and materials. And it just makes it a nice stroll.
Well, one of the things, and you've said that the 1800s, or otherwise known as the 19th century, is your favorite time for cemeteries for these reasons. But let's talk about some of the things that were carved from the marble. I've just opened the book to a really, and I'm going to use the word a little disconcerting, a little creepy, photographs of slumbering children on the top of boxes. These were carved from marble, and were they meant to be the likeness of the child who was buried inside?
Yeah, they might have been the likeness of the child if the carver happened to know the family. But what we find on some of those slumbering children designs is that they look similar to other stones. So it was a basic design that the stonecutter knew how to make. We find those mid-1800s to the end of the 1800s, usually in marble. They are often reset into the stone. So they would carve away the marble into the front of the stone to have a design in relief. But what you're seeing in the book is a couple of examples of stone toppers. So some of these gravestone makers actually created three-dimensional designs of these slumbering children to put on the very top of the stone. They looked interesting and cool, but they erode much more heavily and quickly than a regular flat marker. But the reason they did this was you have to think about what was going on with families in the middle 1800s with respect to communicable diseases. People lost children so frequently, and they would sometimes, a disease would come in, into the family and wipe out five or six kids within a couple of months. And they lost so many, there was this ongoing need to remember. And the design that you're looking at, the slumbering child, is meant to be for the parents to deal with the death of their child by thinking it's just sleeping. So it's a sleeping child, not a dead child. And that's what they embrace about that design in order to deal with the fact that they've lost a child. But they're very interesting, for sure. And there's lambs that are also those stone topper design, three-dimensional lambs also on kids' graves.
Yeah, I learned also from your book, and you're quoting the historian Jeffrey Smith here, as late as the 1880s, a child born had about a 1 in 5 chance of surviving to age 5. Yikes.
Yeah. 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 I mean, things that took families down in those days are all treatable, or mostly treatable today, by antibiotics and better medicine. So we don't see nearly the level of infant mortality that we did at that time. Some of these folks, Jennifer, had never even named their children. So we'll find a grave marker with an unnamed, with no name on it, because the child died before they even had a chance to name them.
Another unusual symbol we see a lot is the tree trunk. And I've learned from you that this can mean a couple different things, but I'm sure anybody who's wandered around cemeteries in Maine has noticed that some graves, instead of an obelisk, might have a tree trunk, a tree that seems to be just sawed off.
Yeah, and that started earlier in the century on slate. The willow tree is considered a weeping willow, often paired with an urn, which is a funerary urn. So you have death and mourning together in one picture. And what the stonecutters did in the earlier days on slate was almost every tree trunk of a willow tree has a broken branch on it. And that's a symbol for a life cut short. And that's the theme of the book. You know, the book is basically stories of people whose lives ended too soon. And these symbols that we're talking about and the inscriptions that we read are all reflective of that theme. So the branch being cut on a tree trunk is a symbol of the life cut short. And they then did them in marble as well. So we see it crossing the line. And so when I give tours, or when I'm telling folks to go through cemeteries, I say you'll find a lot of willow and urns in Maine cemeteries. Just get closer to the stone, take a quick look at it, and see if you can see that broken branch, because it's almost always going to be on there.
And something else that's pretty common is a hand of some sort, either with the palm facing out or a finger pointing up. And is that a finger pointing up to heaven?
Yes, the finger pointing up to heaven was really common, and it gives people hope of, you know, forever life, basically eternal life. And so we do have a lot of fingers pointing up. But you'll also find fingers pointing down, and that doesn't mean they've gone to hell. That means that it's the hand of God pointing down to the person. But the use of the hand in 1850s, 60s markers is really predominant, and they're so interesting to look at, because you can look at the sleeves were carved differently for men versus women. And when they have clasped hands together for a couple, there's an image there for that they're together again in heaven. So all of these designs that we see, you might walk by and just look and say, oh, a hand. But you think about it and look more closely at it, and you start to understand and learn that there's meaning to everything that you see carved into that marker.
You have gone down a little bit of a rabbit hole with a few of the grave markers that have intrigued you
Yes.
over the years. I suspect this could be this could really be overwhelming, but why don't you tell us a story of one of the grave markers that intrigued you and that you discovered that there was a lot more to the story than it seems from the simple grave.
Yeah, that's how I set the book up, really. So, the book is Stories from Maine Cemeteries, Lives Cut Short, and that's the overwhelming theme. Again, is the lives cut short piece of it. All people from the 1800s. That's my favorite period. And one of the stories, the first major story. So there's basically five sort of robust stories in the book, and then 12 chapters that are all including, strike by lightning and the lambs and the slumbering children and all the different symbols that you find. But one of the first stories in the book is a story of a young woman, Bessie Oliver from South Portland. Her father was a sea captain and built a home down on the waterfront. And she was born in 1874, and she left her family behind before 1900 to move to New York City and sort of seek her fortune by herself. While she was there, she married a man in 1900. His name was Brenner. And then we don't hear a whole much about a whole lot more about her until she comes home to die without him a few years later in 1908. And when she died of consumption, which is tuberculosis, at her family home, her father and mother buried her in their lot nearby. And they decorated her grave with a marker that just has her name and her dates, and that she is the wife of Richard Brenner. And what I've heard from the family lore down the generations, the stories have been told that she was a victim of spousal abuse, and that her parents really did not like her husband Brenner at all. And so I thought about this, looking at her stone, which is so simple. It just says wife of Brenner and then her date. I thought, why wouldn't the family have just said daughter of, and then list the parents because she's with them, and he didn't come home with her. And that was the rabbit hole that got me going. It's like, what is this about? There's something behind this. So I ended up doing a ton of research, and I ended up having to go down to New York City to the archives office in order to pull original files. But what I discovered there was that she had married for a second time in 1906 in New York City, and that she claimed that she was a widow, and that this new guy she had married was named Arthur Gordeau, and he didn't come home with her either. But the there's this whole secret life that she led that she never let on to her family. And so in the book, I give you her picture because I got a nice photograph of her in her grave marker, which is not true. And I leave you with the teaser of something happened here. She's got a secret life that her family never knew about. And her grave marker clearly is incorrect. It doesn't reflect who she really was when she died. She did marry the second time, and her husband, Brenner, was still very much alive when she did that. So people need to read the story to get the whole thing, but it was a rabbit hole that took me to New York City.
I
A fun
wonder
trip.
if you just randomly took graves and did some research, if you'd find all sorts of secrets hidden.
I think you might. And one of the things I mention when I talk to people or give tours is every stone here has a story, and we just have to find what that is. And sometimes you look at an interesting symbol or an interesting inscription, and it's enough to lead you down that rabbit hole to find out what that story is. But other times, you hear something or read something in the paper. But yeah, everybody's got a story there. And what I like to do is find the people who weren't famous and help tell their stories.
Well, we're speaking with Ron Romano. His new book is Stories from Maine Cemeteries, Lives Cut Short. We have to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. History and family relationships are part of cemeteries across the state. With me to talk about these, Ron Romano, his new book, Stories from Maine Cemeteries, Lives cut short. Ron gives lectures and guided tours and is on the board of Friends of Eastern Cemetery. Join the conversation. Is there a cemetery that has special meaning for you? Is there a mystery you've always wondered about? Send us a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, or comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Vanna Carmona, who is president of the Prince Project. Thanks so much for calling in, Vanna.
Well, you're very welcome. And hello, Ron.
Hey, Vanna.
Well, so, Vanna, you were on Maine Calling earlier this year for our show about the history of slavery in Maine. But tell us how a visit to a cemetery was the catalyst for your research and your organization, the Prince Project.
Well, Ron and I both understand the meaning of finding a stone and going down a rabbit hole, because that's what happened to me. It's been over 13 years. I was out at a cemetery in Gorham and ran across a stone that said Prince on it. And there was some reference to a family of ours. And so I went back and started studying it and discovered that my ancestors were enslavers and were also complicit in the slave trade. So I started to do some research, and it became the Prince Project, a nonprofit 501c3. That database went up over a year and a half ago with about 2,000 people on it. In fact, just a couple days ago, we discovered that we have now 2,465 people on the database. So we have come up with an additional 400 individuals that were enslaved in Maine or descended from enslavers, enslaved in Maine up until 1800. So that's really growing, and I don't see it stopping either.
Wow. I understand you are leading a tour later this month. Tell us about it and what people can learn about Black history from it.
Certainly. It's going to be August 22nd at 2 o'clock, and that's going to be in Eastern Cemetery in Portland. That's on Congress Street, Cross Streets, Washington Avenue. And it's one of the oldest official burial grounds in the city. And I use it to introduce a lot of the enslavers. So as people come to the tour, the first thing we do is visit many of the graves that were the major enslavers here in Portland, which was Falmouth at the time, and go over about how enslaved people were forced to live and forced to work. And then we can go over, because Eastern Cemetery also has two sections that were for the African-American section. So we go to the older one and then the newer one and discuss all of that as well.
Wonderful. And Ron, I know that one of the stories in your book has to do with the Eastern Cemetery and somebody who might not be buried where they're supposed to be buried, or where the stone may not be correct. We're not sure.
Yes. So Vanna probably knows this one. But before we tell that, I want to just make a comparison to point out how different my life and Vanna's life is, even though we're in the same field. So when I design cemetery tours, and I've done them for 20 different cemeteries in Southern Maine, and I do five that I run regularly in Portland, Scarborough, Biddeford, and Saco. So what goes into designing a cemetery tour is I have to go into the space, walk around, start looking for unusual inscriptions, designs, shapes, whatever. Something's going to catch my fancy. I then have to go home and research it to figure out if there's a story there. And then from there, go back to the cemetery, practice my route and all of that to deliver a good tour to the people that want to come on. And so it's a ton of work to get that done. But who benefits from that are the people that are taking the tour, not everybody else. And so this book is meant to bring all of these great stories I've captured from this work into one place for people to read. But here's the connection with Vanna, is that when I go out and do my work, I'm looking for that unusual thing. But there were so few grave markers placed on African-American graves. When Vanna goes out, she's got to rely on other things than just the grave marker, because there's so few for her to pick from. And she's got a harder job basically putting together a story because of the lack of the monumentation that is, you know, predominant in many of these places. So is that how you see it too, Vanna?
Oh, I think you're absolutely correct. But as we progress through our lives, you know, you and I have known each other now for over 13 years, we know that we learn more about how to find these things and are able to track them down. In fact, on our website, princeproject.org, if you go to videos, we have a little video there that actually tells a very complete story of Prince and how we found him and where is he really buried? I mean, here's a stone, but is he really there? So you're absolutely right. It gets very tricky.
Right. So, Jennifer, back to the question you asked about the stone. There is a grave, a small slate marker at Eastern Cemetery that sort of kicked off a, you know, another rabbit hole and created a really interesting story that's in the book. So it's about a young son of a barber who had a shop down on the waterfront. His name was Ira Gray, excuse me, and his son died at age 3. And there were two records in the burial records for him, one of which named him as Cray, C-R-A-Y, and one of which named him as Gray, G-R-A-Y. One of them called him black, one of them called him white, and they were in two separate sections of the cemetery. So the rabbit hole there really was for me to go figure out, is he a Cray or a Gray? Is he black or is he white? Is his grave in section H or is in section L? And that's really the work that went into this thing. Ultimately, the answers to those questions are that he was in fact a Gray, that's his last name, because we know his father, who was African-American. And we know that he belongs, you know, in the African-American section, that his, somehow his stone got pulled up and across and stuck in the ground in another section of the cemetery. And we're going to fix that, by the way. And he was black. So that's sort of the quick news about the story. But in doing the research on this family, what I discovered was a really scary incident that occurred to the family in 1825. Ira Gray and his wife and the kids were at their home down on Hancock Street, and they were suddenly attacked by a mob of white people who surrounded the house and started throwing stones into the windows and at the house. Ira, in an attempt to, you know, fend off these attackers, stuck a gun out the window and shot. And he happened to hit and kill one of the white attackers. The next morning, he was arrested for manslaughter, for killing this guy. And so the question, when I'm doing a book talk, an author talk, and I tell this piece of it, I always leave this open-ended. The question is, would a black man who killed a white man in 1825 have received a fair trial? And it's up to us to sort of think that through and then read the book to get the answer of how it all plays out, because I'm not going to tell you that part.
I know the answer because I read the book, but I guess...
Don't tell.
Okay. Vanna, before we let you go, remind us, what is the date of the tour and how does somebody sign up?
It's August 22nd at 2 o'clock, and it's right there at the Eastern Cemetery in Portland on Congress Street. I think the address is 224 Congress Street. And you can go to Eventbrite and sign up. We also take walk-ins. It's $10 a person, and that goes absolutely to the Prince Project and as a donation.
Well, thank you for calling in, Vanna Carmona, the leader of the Prince Project. Let's see. We'll go down to York and Torbert. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer, Mr. Romano, and Vanna, the Prince Project. York is one of the two oldest towns in York, depending on what you who you talk to. Kittrey tries to claim it, but most believe York is the oldest. And right in York Village, there is the very oldest cemetery is between the old jail and Jeffords Tavern, and it's. You see people in there constantly making grave rubbings and so on. So, and then behind the First Parish Church, which is an old New England, can't miss it, there is a large graveyard which is laid out chronologically, and you can see the development of the town through the development of the graves. The other thing is the Historical Society has published a map of the family graveyards, which there are at least 180 known ones. So if you get the fancy, you can wander around town checking out the old family graveyards. The third one is the slave issue. Many of the old family graveyards were families that held slaves without acknowledgement in writing or anything, but some recent work with the ground-penetrating radar has found numerous graves around the old family graveyards, which are presumed to be the slaves that belong to that family. Cornucopia of death in that way.
Yeah, and Old York is just a wonderful place to visit if listeners today haven't ever been there. One of your thank you for calling, Torbert. Ron, one of the stories from your book is the Barrel Sons, and they're in Old York.
They are. They're in that very cemetery that he spoke of. Yeah. So, I tried to in this book sort of hit a bunch of different regions of Maine to make it more broadly appealing to people. And so, yeah, York is figuring prominently in that book. I wanted to just say a couple of things to what he said about grave rubbing. I almost said grave robbing. That's a whole other subject we can get into too. But grave rubbing. So a lot of the sites have now banned grave rubbing. So before people do that, they really need to check and make sure it's okay to do. Grave rubbing has been found to actually damage some of these really early markers. So most cemeteries now no longer allow people to do grave rubbings. That's when you tape something on and then use crayon or something or wax. Instead, we want you to go in and take a bunch of great pictures. That's what we try and do there. The other point I was going to make was, he mentioned there's over 100 in private cemeteries in York. Maine has over 8,000 cemeteries. So if you were just to think about which ones you know, you could probably put 15, 20 together on a list. There's 8,000. There's a ton of them. But many, many of them are these really small family lots on private ground, you know, outside in the farm country, et cetera. And so.
Yeah. An email here from Carl in Minot. My father came from Guilford, Connecticut, founded in 1639. My family lived in that town for 350 years. Guilford has a big, iconic town center green. For the first 100 years, they buried their dead on the large village green. From 1818 through 1824, they removed the headstones of the long dead and forgotten citizens to make cemetery walls for the, quote, newer cemeteries on the outskirts of town. The town's early dead remain buried in the village green with no evidence today that it was ever a burial ground. Was that commonly done in New England? It was very practical. The dead had long been forgotten, but the headstones were in the way, so they were moved and repurposed.
Yeah, you know, that's a really sad one. For a cemetery historian like me, who really is wanting to see the preservation of the site to its original, to hear that people are pulling up stones and moving them around and embedding them in cement somewhere is a real cringe moment. So I wish they hadn't done that, but it sounds like they at least retained the stones to make a wall as opposed to just discarding them, which is what some towns decided to do with these old markers, just pull them up and discard them. And, you know, all you need to do is find a couple of great early symbols on a gravestone as you wander around our wonderful cemeteries, and you're going to appreciate that it's a piece of handmade artwork that really should be preserved and not anything else. So yeah, it's tough to hear that towns do that, but sometimes they do. And, you know, families bury their kin there for a reason, you know, and all of a sudden years later, they're dug up and sent around somewhere else.
An email here from Lynette that has a photograph. It says, sad story here. And it's a photograph of a gravestone. And people have clearly been visiting this for years and paying tribute. It says, unknown, unwanted baby boy, body found in Rockport Quarry, April 20th, 1940, about age 5 months.
Yeah. So that is a sad one. And someday maybe we could figure out who that person is by looking at newspaper or police or other records, depending on the year and all of that. But the reality is, it brings us to an interesting little sideline here, talking about paupers' graves. And that's another chapter in my book where I talk about the paupers' field and the paupers' graves in Scarborough. is that towns had to find a place to bury those who died without family, without friends, without money, without any means to buy a plot or get a grave marker. And so they set aside patches in their properties to lay to rest these folks that, were visitors from out of town or whatever. And they typically are called paupers' fields or city lots or city fields. And that's where you find these folks. And so sometimes they went in with unmarked graves, and other times they had a plaque put in to memorialize them. So yeah, it's a sad situation, but it happened again and again. And towns did the best they could to figure out how to bury these folks that were, in their control, basically.
We're talking about Maine's old cemeteries and some of the people who were buried in them. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. If you find cemeteries intriguing, you are not the only one. My guest today finds them very intriguing. In fact, he's written books about them. His most recent book, Stories from Maine Cemeteries, Lives Cut Short. Ron Romano is an author and a speaker, and he leads cemetery tours. Share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here from Helen regarding the subject of Maine cemeteries. I would like to let you know about the Maine State Cemetery Preservation Commission, an independent state commission established in 2021. It started as an advisory commission and is now an independent commission. The commission is responsible for advising and educating municipalities and the public on the care and preservation of burying grounds and cemeteries and the graves, walls, and fences within them. She goes on to say, cemeteries should be cared for, preserved, and respected, not just as places of burial, but for the historic information carried on their gravestones and the artwork on those stories. And Ron, I'm sure you couldn't agree more.
I couldn't agree more. That's Helen Shaw, isn't it? Who wrote that?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. She's with the Maine Old Cemetery Association group, which I am part of as well. And I recommend anybody who's interested in learning more history about Maine's cemeteries to get onto their website, MOCA, Maine Old Cemetery Association, doing some wonderful work throughout the state to preserve and educate on the national level. The Association for Gravestone Studies, AGS, is another great organization. I served on their board for 6 years and just actually got a nice award from them last month for my work. So both of those at national and local are good places to scope out more information.
An email from Jamie. Every year, the Royal River Community Players teams up with the Yarmouth Historical Society to present Stroll Haunted Yarmouth, an immersive theatrical experience in which audiences are guided through the hillside cemetery to watch true stories brought to life at the grave sites of the area's historical residents. It's a lot of fun for grown-ups and kids, and if you want to be part of the cast, you can audition for a role tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Playhouse on Route 1 in Yarmouth. For more information, go to royalrivercommunityplayers.com. Ron, have you ever seen that?
I have, in fact, I wrote in my first book, which was about Stonecutter Bartlett Adams. They ended up playing his two daughters a couple of years ago in their show. And I got a phone call and they said, we used your book. We're going to put the two daughters of Bartlett Adams in the show. So I went out. These wonderful two young women were playing the daughters of the stonecutter. And I went out to meet them. And honestly, it was so much fun because they were like dazzled that I would show up to, see them. And I was just dazzled because they were, putting the show on. So yeah, it's a great show. I recommend it. But there's a second one that you definitely need to know about as well. Through Eastern Cemetery, the Friends of Eastern Cemetery, Spirits Alive, every October we do 2 weeks called Walk Among the Shadows. And it's a similar thing where we have costumed actors who take on the persona of people within our cemetery. And we put on a show every night, multiple shows every night for 2 weeks. And it's just a great, great time. And, we're a nonprofit group too, so that's helpful for us to preserve the cemetery. So, yeah, look for that as well in the fall.
We'll go to Jennifer calling from Waldo. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm the sexton for the town of Waldo, and I have an interesting stone, cenotaph. I think we spoke about earlier about stones that represent someone who is not actually buried in that cemetery. So I wondered if you want, if I could read this to you.
Sure.
Okay. So in memory of John Wesley Young, Leonard Levenseller's adopted son, his body out in Georgetown lies, his spirit dwells above the skies, died February 22nd, 1864. He was 16 years old the day before. He was a soldier, young and brave. He died his country's life to save.
Wow, that's really moving.
Yeah, and we have go ahead.
We have another cenotaph, but I couldn't find it quickly enough to include it in this of another veteran, and many veterans. We probably have 144, I think we have veterans in Waldo's cemeteries alone.
And right. Jennifer, I'm glad you brought this up. Yeah. That I did. I learned this word from Ron's book, cenotaph, and I was going to ask you, Ron, how to pronounce it. Cenotaph, and that is a memorial to someone who's not actually buried there. The body is not there, but you're a memorial. And a lot of people who died at sea have cenotaphs.
Yeah, lost at sea. Yeah, so cenotaph. That's correct. That's what we call it. And so when we're talking in when you say a gravestone, that applies to the stone that's there. If you say grave marker, technically that's a grave, it's a stone marking the actual grave. The cenotaph is a gravestone marking an empty grave. So, you know, there's these technicalities around what in the biz sort of, but we don't worry about it. You know, when people come in and say they went to the graveyard, I say, great. You know, technically they probably didn't go to a graveyard. They went to a burying ground or something else, but you know, it's all good. I just want to have people come in and take their walks and enjoy it, and they call it what they want.
Jennifer, thanks for calling. An email here from Kim. The Pine Grove Cemetery, located in Waterville, has all the gravestone compositions mentioned from slate to zinc. The design pattern wagon wheel offers a stroll of interest. From Civil War soldiers to prominent members of city society, including the first African-American graduate of Colby College, the cemetery visit provides historical perspective. And you can consult the Waterville City website for more information. So tell us, Kim mentioned something called a wagon wheel pattern. What is that, Ron, and what does it represent?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I know which one that is. It's funny, I was just up there touring that very cemetery with the new director of the cemetery, Deb Gagnon, who's a wonderful person and just jumped into this, doing a great job. But I'm going to shift the gears a little bit because I don't know the wagon wheel. I'm not sure what that is. Sometimes the carvers created, architectural looking symbols and sometimes geometric shapes that have some meaning to them. If there are letters, it could be a symbol for a mason or something like that. So I'm not sure exactly without seeing it, but I did want to mention this about Pine Grove in Waterville because it's a fabulous cemetery. When I met with Deb to take a walkthrough, she hosted me on a walkthrough to show the site. She was talking about the potter's fields. And I said, potter's fields? I said, you don't have any potter's fields here. I said, you have pauper's fields, but not potter's fields. She said, well, I'm pretty sure they're potter's fields. So we looked at the old maps. And in fact, the maps do say potter's fields. So when I did a presentation for them later that day or the next day, we had a discussion about it to clarify it. And I'll do that very quickly for you. A potter's field has a very specific meaning. Over in Europe, when the people who made clay pots would go out and get their source material, they would dig holes in the clay grounds, dig lots of holes to get their source material and leave the holes behind. Many years later, there was these fields with all these giant holes in them where they had taken the clay out. And somebody had a brilliant idea of let's fill them with bodies of paupers. So they became, you know, pauper grave sites. Over here in the US, we never did that. We didn't use clay fields abandoned to be burial spaces, but the term potter's field came across the water, and there are some people who call them potter's field when they're really a pauper's field. So just another clarification.
An email here from Derek and Herman. I'm a little late here, but my father and I have been interested in restoring headstones in old cemeteries, ones that are badly broken or leaning mostly. He is an experienced mason. We just don't know where to start or who to reach out to. So, Ron, in Herman, in the Bangor area, where would you recommend someone start? Would you call the town or the sextant for the cemetery?
Yes, so you do need to get permission. The laws in Maine say that you do need to get permission before you work on a historic marker. So you need to go to the right place to get permission, whether it's a city cemetery, a private ground, an association-led cemetery. Really need to start there to let them know what you would like to do, and they can give you the yes or the no. You also really need to go through a training program so that you know what you're doing, because we don't want to have more damage done to stones because people don't know how to do it. And the best way to learn how to properly care for a stone is to join MoCA and AGS, or go to Spirits Alive in Portland on Saturdays. We do conservation workshops and teach people how to do it. But start with looking online at Maine Old Cemetery Association to see videos of how to actually do this work. So you've got to get permission, you've got to get trained and how to do it, and then use the proper materials. Nothing that's going to damage the stone. No metal, no chemicals, none of that. We want these to last forever. So great care has to be taken to do any work.
We'll go to Marilyn, who's on the road. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So a number of many years ago, actually, I was working for a firm in Portland. I'm an architect, and we were designing a school for the towns of Limerick and Newfield. And the site was in both towns. And the town line actually ran, we sited it, sited the building, so the town line ran through the building. And during preparation for excavation, they hadn't started excavation yet, they discovered a headstone of a young girl who was just over 5 years old. And it was Lavinia Piper. Her parents were Asa and Sophia. They were well known in that area. And she was one of several children of theirs. And we had to stop the construction, and we actually relocated the school further away. Nothing was excavated, so we don't know if it was a real, you know, if she actually is buried there. But the headstone, it was a small black slate headstone, and I just thought it was so meaningful that it was a young child, and we were building an elementary school there. So the school did get built, and but that was an interesting experience to go through.
I'm sure. Ron.
Yeah, so where is the stone now? Do you know?
I believe it was left where we found it. It
Oh,
was
good.
kind of leaning, it was leaning up against a tree. We just didn't touch. We contacted the state,
Yeah.
and you know, we worked with the state on what we were happy we could stay on that site, so that, because it was important to both towns that the school was on a property that had both town,
Yeah.
you know, areas within it. So we were happy that we were able to continue with construction. As far as I know, I haven't been there in a long time. As far as I
Yeah.
know, it's still there. I don't
Okay.
know where the rest of the family has been buried, but
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marilyn. And you know, it does, there's so many of them, but every time you encounter a stone of a child, it's kind
Yeah.
of hard to take.
It is. I agree.
Ron, we just have a little bit less than a minute left. I wanted to ask you, for all of us who like to wander around old cemeteries, what is a piece of wisdom or a tip that you would give us about looking at headstones, maybe a little differently?
Yeah, I think, I really encourage you to just go visit and just take your time and walk through and stop and look at some of these things. Sometimes the design is going to pop out at you, and it's just worth pausing and looking at. But then read the words. Sometimes they put cause of death on there: struck by lightning, killed by a horse, fell from a building, other things like that, which really help tell this person's story. You're going to notice that the references to men and women differ. Men are listed by their accomplishments, women by their relationships. People had labels on their markers. Women are called relics and consorts instead of widows and wives. And that's all gone away. That was all 1800 stuff. But there's so much to see that I just encourage you to go out and look and find something, stop and pause and think about it, take a picture of it, and enjoy it. And
Well,
read
thank
my
you
book.
so Well,
Right?
I'm about to give the
Ooh.
name of it. Thank you so much
Yeah.
for joining us, Ron Romano, author of Stories from Maine Cemeteries, Lives Cut Short. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, much has happened in the week since the ICE shooting in Biddeford, that fatal shooting. We will examine the repercussions of that event. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.